I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Protesters in eastern Ukraine continue to occupy government buildings, saying they will not leave until the government in Kiev steps down. This is in defiance of an agreement hammered out by Russia, Ukraine, the U.S., and the European Union in Geneva last Thursday in efforts to defuse the crisis in Ukraine. Yesterday, Ukraine's interim prime minister accused Russian President Vladimir Putin of trying to, quote, restore the Soviet Union in an interview on Meet the Press. Putin had referred to eastern Ukraine as New Russia in a TV call-in show last week. Clearly, the next few days will be critical ones to watch, especially after a shootout at a checkpoint yesterday in eastern Ukraine. We asked Corey Flintoff to join us. He's NPR correspondent based in Moscow. And Corey, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Nice to be back.
What can you tell us about the shootout? And I ask it because there's a fair amount of finger-pointing going on.
Yes, absolutely. It started this morning with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who said that this shows that the government in Kiev has no interest in reining in its own extremist elements. Russia is insisting that the attack was carried out by members of a group called the Right Sector, the ultra-nationalist group that was responsible for violence in Kiev during the Maidan uprising. So far, we've seen no evidence of that. But, you know, that's what the Russian media are telling the Russian public. And what it looks like, at least from this perspective, is that Kiev basically broke the Geneva Agreement, as Lavrov said they did. He called it a crude violation of the Geneva Agreement, and this is, you know, only a matter of days after it was made.
What part of eastern Ukraine are we talking about? Where did this shootout take place?
Slavyansk, which is, you know, a relatively smaller town in eastern Ukraine, but it's the one where in some ways the pro-Russian separatists seem to have their strongest grip. You know, they took it over, and it's also one of the locations where the so-called green men, these gunmen who rather well-equipped gunmen wearing green camouflage without identifying marks, have turned up. And of course, the United States and NATO are saying that these are probably Russian special forces.
Is there any way to know that? And I asked, there was actually a piece in the New York Times that seemed to unmask the green men today.
You know, it's very difficult to know that for sure. But, you know, as long as there's any degree of ambiguity about who they are, Russia can have a certain amount of deniability. And, you know, without being there myself, I can't tell you that these people are actually Russian service people, but everyone says that, you know, especially the armaments they're carrying and their tactics and their discipline suggest that they are military.
How is the Russian press, the Russian media, how are they covering this crisis in Ukraine?
I would say it's overwhelmingly negative as far as the coverage of the protesters who ousted President Yanukovych in Ukraine and the current interim Ukrainian government. And it's overwhelmingly positive as far as things like the Russian annexation of Crimea. You know, this is constant, I would even say relentless, on state-run television in Moscow and everywhere else. I mean, in Moscow, you see big posters that say Krim Nash, or Crimea is ours. Mm. Later this week, there's going to be a series of patriotic events that are centered around that orange and black stripe ribbon that you've probably seen on television. It's a ribbon that dates from Tsarist times. It's called the Order of St. George, and it's been adopted by a lot of people as a sign of Russian patriotism, especially support for what's going on in Ukraine. So people really seem to have internalized all the patriotic slogans and the news coverage, and they believe that Russia is in the right when it comes to its policy toward Ukraine.
Are there signs that eastern Ukraine or Ukraine is ours?
Well, they're not saying that yet.
But nonetheless, this TV talk show or call-in show, question and answer show last week that Putin hosted, he did talk about eastern Ukraine as New Russia. Is that significant, Corey?
It is, because, well, there are different interpretations of what New Russia means, but it's a historical term that refers to this area going back to the time of the Tsarist conquest of it, which was in the 17th and 18th centuries. So that includes this regions of around Donetsk, the so-called Donbass, which is this great pool of coal country that exists there, and it's the sort of industrial heartland of eastern Ukraine, and it goes all the way down to the coast, to Crimea, and westward to Odessa as well, Ukraine's major seaport.
Help us understand this this show that was on last Thursday. My understanding, it was almost 4 hours long, which seems unbelievable. talking to you from the United States, hard to imagine that President Obama would do something like that. What did it look like, and what did he say that you think is significant?
Well, you know, Putin does this call-in show every year, and he does pride himself on his stamina in answering the questions. And you know, we can see why he likes to do these shows. You know, for one thing, he's quite good at this kind of format. He's very relaxed. He's very much in command, and he can always quote facts and figures about every question that comes up. You know, of course, it has to be pointed out that the calls are all very carefully pre-screened and selected, so there won't be any surprises, and also, you know, so the questions won't be too challenging. But much of this year's session was devoted to Crimea and to the situation in Ukraine. There was a whole segment from Crimea. They set up a pre-selected group of citizens who basically thanked him for taking them back into Russia. Putin also got in a lot of shots at the United States and the West. He's basically blaming them for the crisis in Ukraine and accusing them of fomenting the revolution that basically eventually led to the ouster of Yanukovych. You know, so all in all, the call-in was a reinforcement of everything that the Russian media have been telling people for the last 4 months.
There was also a call from Edward Snowden. Was that pre-screened, do you think, Corey?
Sure.
Any way to know that?
Actually, it was pre-recorded, but it did come as a real surprise, you know, to the public. He asked whether Russia conducts mass surveillance of its citizens. And that, of course, gave Putin the opportunity to say, well, no, we'd never do anything like that. And interestingly, you know, there were two kinds of reactions to Snowden's question. On the one hand, a lot of people said, this just proves that Snowden is a patsy for the Kremlin. You know, he's asking a softball question that brings up the topic of U.S. surveillance, and it's basically designed to make Russia look good. Snowden himself tried to defend himself the following day in a comment in the Guardian newspaper in Britain. He said that he was trying to challenge Putin by asking a question that was patterned after a question that was asked about a year ago of the National Security Director, James Clapper, mm-hmm. and it was asked by Senator Ron Wyden, who wanted to know if the United States conducts surveillance on millions of its citizens. And, of course, Clapper said no. Mm-hmm. So Snowden said that he was trying to put Putin in a position where he'd have to either say no or come clean about what Russia really does in terms of mass surveillance.
Same question, two different questioners, but same answer.
Exactly.
Are there dissident voices? And I'm thinking about, you know, in so many parts of the world, there's social media, there's Twitter, often representing a different point of view than the government point of view. Are you seeing that in Russia at all?
There are dissident voices, and I saw some of them in person Sunday before last when there was a demonstration against media censorship here. You know, so I went to this demonstration on a Sunday afternoon. It was a very nice day, so there was a good turnout, but it only amounted to a matter of a few thousand people, and they were faces that I recognized from previous demonstrations. In fact, you know, the turnout at big demonstration is declining. People, I think, are feeling rather hopeless. And in fact, independent media where people can voice opposition opinions are gradually shrinking. The major independent TV channel is called Rain, Dosht, was taken off the air by cable providers. And there's some doubt as whether it'll get back on again. The editor-in-chief of Lenta.ru, one of the major independent news websites, was replaced by someone who's said to be more friendly to the Kremlin. And there was a measure just passed, in fact, that makes bloggers, if you have a blog that gets more than 3,000 hits a day, you are considered, you're required to register as a member of the news media, as a news media outlet, and then you come under all kinds of regulation that affects newspapers and television and that sort of thing.
Does that represent a change on in how the Kremlin is dealing with the press?
Absolutely. Well, it's not a change. This is something that's been going on roughly since President Putin returned as president in May of 2012. But I think it's accelerating, and one of the reasons that it's accelerating is because the Kremlin is consolidating its control of news media as this Ukraine crisis goes on.
What is the economy like in Russia, broadly speaking?
You know, the Russian economy is not in great shape, and most economists believe that right now it's in a period of stagnation that could tilt over into recession. You know, I mean, the reason we're all concerned about this is the question of whether sanctions are going to have any effect on this economy. Economists will tell you that the fundamentals of Russia's economy are still pretty strong, and that's mainly because it's one of the biggest producers of oil and gas. The government relies very strongly on oil and gas revenues for its budget, but it has built up substantial rainy day funds, you know, that can help cushion any economic downturns. Russia doesn't have a terribly high national deficit, so basically the Russian economy can be very resilient, you know, and can weather economic downturns. It's the long run that is the question here, and economists say that one of the biggest dangers for Russia right now is capital flight, meaning that Russian businesses and wealthy Russians are getting their money out of the country as fast as they can, mainly because they don't see much future for investment in their own economy. You know, one estimate that I heard just recently is that more money was moved out of Russia in the last quarter, and that's the first quarter of this year, than in all of the previous year.
Wow.
And that's not being made up by foreign investment. You know, foreign investment in Russia is quite low because investors aren't sure whether they might be hit by international sanctions. And, you know, even if that wasn't a danger, Russia ranks very high on these various ratings of corruption and lack of independent judiciary and obstacles to doing business. You know, all the things that international businesses look at when they're thinking about investing in a country.
Well, we could go on.
The long-term answer would seem to be that Russia's economic future doesn't look good.
Well, Corey Flintoff, thank you once again for joining us on Radio Times. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure talking to you, as always, Marty.
Thanks so much. And he's NPR correspondent, and he's based in Moscow, getting our conversation started, a kind of a snapshot about what's going on in Russia. We'll be talking about Russia, the EU, the U.S., and Ukraine after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
AS1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, AS1812's annual political comedy, This is the Week That Is. Written and performed by Philadelphia's own Jennifer Childs and This is the Week That Is Ensemble, this annual political satire features a script that changes with the headlines and up-to-the-minute reporting on the day's most important news, from Russian invasions to dog curbing in South Philadelphia. Tickets at AS1812Productions.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Children's books have animals and wizards and heroes, but why aren't there more people of color?
These books are used as ways that kids can make roadmaps for their own lives. And if we don't give them proper roadmaps, where are they going to end up?
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School with day and residential options is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe intellectual disabilities. Camp Hill's curriculum includes music, art, drama, the sciences, life and social skills development, animal husbandry, and horticulture. Camp Hill Special School is hosting an open house at their Chester County campus on Wednesday, May 14th at 9 a.m. Details at camphillspecialschool.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we are talking once again about the crisis in Ukraine, talking about Russia's relationship with the U.S. and the West, what has been happening in Ukraine over the last couple of days. And joining us are Angela Stent. She's director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University, author of a new book called The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russia Relations in the 21st Century. Angela Stent, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be on your show.
And also with us is Charles Kupchin, and he's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, an expert in U.S. foreign policy and diplomacy, also at Georgetown University. And Charles Kupchin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Glad to be with you.
And to our listeners, lines always open at 1-888-477-9499. Angela Stent, if I can go back to you, I know you were listening in as Corey Flintoff was describing the situation in Russia. Do you think this Geneva agreement will hold or even has any teeth in it?
It's very hard to see how it will hold because it was never clear who was going to enforce it, who is going to go and ensure that the separatists that are occupying all these buildings in eastern towns, who's going to disarm them and make sure that they leave the buildings. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, has monitors on the ground, but they're unarmed and they can only use persuasion. And then, as we heard in your report earlier on, the Russian foreign minister says the West is at fault because the West should be disarming the groups that are in Kiev in the Maidan Square. I think the U.S. and the European understanding of this is that you have to de-escalate the situation in eastern Ukraine, and yet nothing's happening there. So I'm very skeptical that anything can be done with this Geneva Accord.
How about for you, Charles Kupchin? How do you see the possibility of de-escalating this crisis?
I agree with Angela that the situation on the ground is not good, and the Russians seem to have basically done something to stave off further sanctions from Washington, but not really back down. And there have been reports over the last 48 hours that these guys who are in the administrative buildings and the police headquarters in eastern Ukraine are not pro-Russian Ukrainians. They're Russians. Mm. Russian intelligence and military operatives who have been seen in Crimea, and they're the ones that are trying to provoke the violence and trying to create trouble. Whether Putin is ready to insert troops into eastern Ukraine is another matter. So far, he seems to be holding off. He seems to be concluding that he can get what he wants, which is influence in eastern Ukraine, influence in the over the government that emerges in Kiev without inserting troops. But that could change today. It could change tomorrow. So we're still very much in a dangerous place when it comes to the situation in the East and the prospect of further Russian incursion.
Angela Stent, do you see some parallels to what happened in Crimea a month or so ago? Now, of course, there was this vote in Crimea, but nonetheless, the fact that there are still Russian troops on the border.
Well, I think that there are obviously some parallels to Crimea. I would disagree a little bit with Charles in that the Russians say that there shouldn't be an election next month in Kiev, in Ukraine, that this is an illegitimate government. So I think on the one hand, the Russians are trying to destabilize the situation there, and we do believe that there are quite a lot of Russians involved there, to the point where the election won't be seen as legitimate because large numbers of people won't vote or it'll be disrupted by violent incidents. And I think beyond that, they have a very clear goal of what they want there, and this would be short of annexing these provinces, and that is for Ukraine to declare itself neutral in perpetuity. In other words, it's never going to join NATO, and it's not going to have an association or stronger arrangement with the European Union. And then it wants to federalize Ukraine. It wants Ukraine to have a very weak central government and devolve powers to these areas, particularly the eastern Ukraine, where Russia would then have inordinate influence. So I think they don't need to send in troops and actually physically take over any of these places at the moment. But what they can do is operate in this gray zone where we're never quite sure who belongs to which militia because they don't have insignia, and to destabilize the situation. And it's almost like a creeping civil war. It isn't a civil war, but it's the total destabilization of that part of the country. And they've already dismembered Ukraine by annexing Crimea. So it's a very weak Ukraine going forward with very strong Russian influence. I think that's what they're seeking at the moment.
Charles Kupchan, Vice President Joe Biden will be in Ukraine today. Do you see this as a kind of symbolic visit by the Vice President to stand with the government in Kiev?
Yes, it is symbolic, and I think that the United States and its European partners are in somewhat of an awkward spot in the sense that nobody is really talking about using military force to reverse what the Russians are doing. Because of facts on the ground and history in eastern Ukraine that has been part of Russia in one form or another since the 17th century, this is a very divided country with a very ambiguous national identity. And I think the Obama administration has more or less arrived at the right spot, which is to say, we support the government in Kiev. We will assist that government in moving forward with political and economic reform. If Russia goes further, that is to say, inserts troops into eastern Ukraine, we will respond by increasing economic sanctions, targeting broad industrial sectors as well as the banking sector. But right now, I think the U.S. really is left with more or less symbolic moves, sending the vice president to Kiev, having relatively small troop maneuvers in the Baltic countries and in Poland, the NATO folks saying, we are worried about what's happening, we're going to spend more time and money defending the eastern frontier of NATO. This is all about sending a message to the Russians that if you are not careful and if you continue down the road you're on, you will succeed in remilitarizing your relationship with the Atlantic democracies.
Angela Sent, you actually quote something that Vladimir Putin said to then-President George W. Bush. This was back in 2008. It was a NATO summit in Bucharest, and he said, and I'm quoting here, I'm quoting you who are quoting who quoted him, you have to understand, George, that Ukraine is not even a country. Part of its territory is in Eastern Europe, and the greater part was given to us. This is, of course, this very complicated history in this part of the world.
It certainly is. And I think for most Russians, Ukrainians do not constitute a separate nation. They're part of the broader kind of Slavic nation. The Russian state began in Kiev, 1,000 years ago. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, it really was very difficult for many Russians to accept that Ukraine was a separate country. And then, as Charles has already said, I mean, it does, the country itself is divided between the western part that was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire before the First World War, that was part of Poland in the interwar years, and that's always had a much more of a European identity. And then the eastern part of the country, which, by the way, is the industrial heartland. It's where a lot of the military-industrial complex is still very closely tied to Russia in that sense. And those and that part of the country has been more or less part of Russia for several centuries, certainly since Catherine the Great's time in the 18th century. So it is a divided country, but I would also say things have changed. Younger people in the East don't have this kind of affiliation with Russia or the Soviet Union. They are more interested in being European, in looking to Europe, in being much more modern. So I think these identities are not frozen in stone, but certainly there's a certain generation that does look to Russia. And I think we also have to say that the problem with Ukraine in the last 22 years is it has really failed to develop sort of effective institutions of government, the rule of law. It's a very corrupt society. And so a lot of people look really with disgust over how they've been governed for the last 22 years, and that's why they've been taking to the streets in Kiev. And for those people, there isn't that much loyalty to the central Kiev government, and this is also a poor society. I mean, right now, the people who are in Crimea are better off in Russia than they were in Ukraine, because suddenly their pensions have risen and social services are better. So, again, very complicated and divided loyalties.
And that's Angela Stent. She's director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University. She's got a new book. It's titled The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russia Relations in the 21st Century. Charles Kupchin also with us. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, also at Georgetown University, and an expert in U.S. foreign policy and diplomacy. And we are talking about the Geneva Pact that was hammered out last week, Putin's relationship with the West, and Ukraine's future. And again, lines open, questions or comments, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Charles Kupchin, do you think Vladimir Putin wants to rebuild what was the Soviet Union, or some version of that?
I think that probably puts it a little too starkly, in that a lot of the Soviet Union is gone. That is to say that the Soviet Union has been dismantled. The Warsaw Pact is no longer, and many of its members are now part of NATO. But what I think Putin does want to do is reconstitute some kind of geopolitical slash cultural bloc with Russia at the center. And if you go back and you look at the speeches that he's been making in Moscow, the question and answer four-hour session on television that he did a couple of days ago, it's clear that he has in mind some kind of reconstitution of a Slavic slash Orthodox slash Eurasian Union that would restore a sense of status and great power aspiration to Russia. And in many ways, I see this both as part of his long-term vision, but also as a response to what happened in Kiev a few months ago, where you had a pro-Russian individual, Viktor Yanukovych, who was the leader. He was effectively chased out of the country as a criminal because tens of thousands of people were in the street. And one of the things they were saying is, we don't want to be part of this Eurasian Union. We don't want to look like Russia. We want to look like our friends who have joined the European Union. And in many respects, it was a very, very serious strategic and tactical blow to Putin. And I think he's responded by grabbing Crimea, which is an area of great historical and cultural significance to the Russians. And now he is flexing his muscles in eastern Ukraine. But in many respects, it's more a sign of Putin's weakness than it is of his strength. And I think in the long term, this is a setback for Russia, not a step forward.
Do you see it that way, Angela Stent? And you've written about this idea of a Eurasian Union.
Well, it is a setback in as much as Putin's dream, before Mr. Yanukovych fled in February, was to create, it's still his policy for this term, to create a Eurasian Union, a sort of more than a customs union, also, as Charles said, having geopolitical implications. And Ukraine would have been the key country in this. And now with what's happened, yes, Crimea is part of Russia, but it's highly unlikely that the rest of Ukraine would join this Eurasian Union, has really any desire to do so. And so whatever Eurasian Union he creates in the future will be a rump Eurasian Union. But on the other hand, his major goal, again, is to prevent Ukraine from, or any Western structures, NATO or the European Union, from encroaching on the former Soviet space. And that he has actually achieved. He is threatening other parts of the former Soviet Union, like the Transnistria region, which is technically part of Moldova, but is a separatist region and has said it wants to join Russia. You know, he said that he reserves the right to defend the interests of all Russian speakers and Russians in parts of the former Soviet Union who feel threatened, what people have called in shorthand the Sudetenland defense. And that's still out there. And so we could see a further kind of disintegration of a country even like Moldova, depending on, what happens in the future. In the longer run, Charles is right. This isn't going to strengthen Russia. And you heard from Corey Flintoff. I mean, the projections I've read about the Russian economy are that the growth rate, from the finance minister, said it's going to be at least a zero this year, or it could be minus. Yes, the Russian economy is reasonably resilient, but in the longer run, this can only have a detrimental effect. And so at some point, Putin will presumably have to clamp down more tightly domestically to counter the effects of people's living standards falling. So in the long run, this probably isn't a good move for Russia, but right now you wouldn't know it. He has more than 80% popularity rate, and that, you know, their patriotic fervor is being expressed again. We heard that, including from people, not only from nationalists in Russia, but from people whom one would have previously identified as more part of the kind of liberal intelligentsia.
Charles Kupchin, let me go back to you. And you had mentioned the level of corruption in Ukraine, and if organizations are going to help rebuild that economy or take care of some of their debt, I'm assuming they're going to want some pretty serious and systemic reforms to make sure that money isn't going to go down some kind of a rabbit hole.
Yes, that's exactly right. And it's one of the reasons that the International Monetary Fund has been working quickly to get money there, but cautiously, because they don't want to pour water down a sand hole. And Angela was saying that if you look back at the last 20 years of Ukrainian history, it's not pretty. There was really a dismantling of the command economy following the collapse of the Soviet Union, but there wasn't a full speed ahead move to what one would call a market economy. It got stuck in the middle. And as a consequence, you had a lot of the private sector get scooped up by former communist apparatchiks. You have widespread corruption. You have institutions of governance that haven't really been working. You have low levels of confidence in both the governing institutions and in the business folks, the oligarchs. And so there's a lot of hard work to be done. And unfortunately, what's happening now in eastern Ukraine is just distracting attention from that hard work and sapping the ability of the government in Kiev to do what it needs to do, which is get its house in order. And I think that the U.S., the IMF, the European Union need to try to push forward the diplomacy to prevent a civil war in the country, but make sure that at the same time they're moving forward on this reform front, because in the end of the day, what one needs to see in Ukraine is a functioning state that is able to stand on its own.
And we're almost up in a break here, Angela Stimpen. But how does one become a billionaire in Ukraine?
Well, you know, it was pretty easy in the 90s. Ukraine has quite a lot of natural resources. These were scooped up by various people, again, as Charles has said, some of whom were, you know, former communists. They've done very well as capitalists, too. And then very close ties with Russian corrupt oligarchs. And the entire gas trade, the energy trade between Russia and Ukraine has been a source of tremendous corruption and wealth, both for Ukrainian and Russian oligarchs. So sometimes we have to be very careful. We sometimes look at this as Ukraine versus Russia, but in some of these business dealings, which are not transparent, the Ukrainians and Russians are working very well together. So it was taking advantage of the disintegration of the Soviet Union in the 1990s. There were no rules of the game. There was no rule of law. And then scooping up, the raw materials and some of these other factories.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Angela Stent and Charles Kupchin. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Temple Beth Zion Beth Israel supports WHYY and announces its inaugural lecture on Jewish thought and psychoanalysis entitled Freud, Moses, and the Holocaust, Sunday, April 27th at 4 p.m. Noted historian and professor Dr. Eli Zaretsky will explore the relationship between Eastern European Jewish culture, the unconscious, the Holocaust, and the prevalence of Jewish psychiatrists and psychologists. Registration at bzbi.org and at jewishthoughtandpsychoanalysis.com.
Humor unites us. Studies say that laughter can lengthen our lives, sharpen our cognition, and release tension. But what makes us laugh? I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, We'll talk with author and comedian Bob Saget and cognitive scientist Scott Weems about how and why we laugh. Today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
Support for WHYY comes from Nemours Alfred I. DuPont Hospital for Children in Wilmington, Delaware, where the hospital's new expansion offers the promise of hope and healing to children and their families. Opening this fall, it will include a state-of-the-art emergency department, spacious private rooms, and a nurturing healing garden. Designed by families, for families, it offers advanced pediatric care and peace of mind. More information at Nemours.org. Nemours Alfred I. DuPont Hospital supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Last week, Russia, Ukraine, the United States, and the European Union reached an agreement in an effort to defuse the crisis in Ukraine. Today, we are exploring the strength and fragility of that pact, Putin's relationship with the West, and Ukraine's future. And again, our guests are Angela Stent, director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University. Her new book is The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russia Relations in the 21st Century. Also with us, Charles Kupchin, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, also at Georgetown. And again, calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me just put something else on the table, then we'll get to all of our callers and our tweeters and emailers. And this is to you, Charles Kupchin. How much does the fact that Russia has gas, natural gas and has oil, how much does that tie the hands of whatever the EU can do?
It's a huge factor. A lot of the gas that is used in Germany, in Poland, in Bulgaria, in Romania comes from Russia, and much of that flows through pipelines that go from Russia through Ukraine into Central Europe. And in that respect, when the Europeans are looking at the prospect of deeper economic sanctions, they are reluctant. Right now, you know, one hears different things about where European leaders are. That is to say, some reports suggest that if the United States were to say it's time to move ahead with deep sanctions, cut off the banking system, cut off some industrial sectors, deal with the prospect of Russia turning off the spigot when it comes to those gas pipelines, they're ready to go. Others say that the Europeans are hanging a bit back behind the United States. We won't know the real situation unless we get to a point where those sanctions are now on the table. And the Geneva Accord, the Geneva Agreement that you've been speaking about, effectively put this issue on hold. There are also some steps that are being taken to try to, for example, reverse the flow of gas from Central Europe into Ukraine, because it was a relatively warm winter in Europe, despite the cold here in the United States. That means there are reserves in Central Europe, and should the Russians try to use the gas as a diplomatic weapon, the Europeans have suggested that they would try to send some gas into Ukraine to try to alleviate shortages.
Angela, we have a tweet from Janine. Could they talk about or comment on the similarities or differences between what is happening now and to what was happening in Georgia back in 2008? Do you see some parallels?
Yes, let me just add one thing to what Charles just said. The German Foreign Minister Steinmeier has now said in two interviews over the weekend that he does not believe that further sanctions are the answer, and that the only way to deal with this is to get everyone to step back and to defuse the tensions in the situation. So I think going forward, it would be pretty difficult to get German agreement on some of this. There are some parallels with Georgia, obviously, where Russia said that it was coming to the assistance of people who were being threatened by the Georgian government. And of course, then Russia went to war with Georgia and then declared these two breakaway provinces, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, independent. even though only a few other countries in the world have recognized this. But so far, unlike in Georgia, the Ukrainian government is being very, very careful about what it's doing. I think also the EU and the U.S. Are trying to persuade the Ukrainian government, indeed, not to provoke the Russians. That was not true in the Russia-Georgia case. There were provocations, and the Georgian president, Saakashvili, allowed himself to be provoked. So I think that is definitely one big difference. But there are parallels in the rhetoric and also the fact that the Russians are now making it easier for Russian speakers in eastern Ukraine to get Russian passports. That's what they were doing in Georgia before the war, handing out passports too. So, but I think that the political context is different. And I think right now the U.S. and the EU are much more involved in trying to prevent a war than they were in Georgia in 2008.
Let me get Tim from Ardmore to join our conversation. Hi, Tim. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Yeah, I teach genocide out at Villanova, and one of the sections we do is really looking at Milosevic and the way that he kind of shifted his rhetoric to, and I think it's a kind of an unusual shift, to really understand Serbia not in a nationalistic or bordered by a border, but the idea that wherever there are Serbians, they are living on Serbian soil. And he really used that as a rhetoric, expanding Serbia. So if anyone was Serbian and they were living outside of the bounds of Serbia, that meant that they were living on Serbian soil, and therefore he could justify, military expansion and to protect them as a greater Serbia. And Putin seems to be following that same kind of rhetoric, that if there are Russians, even if they're outside of Russia, he can use that as a leverage, as a way, as they are Russian because they are, or they're Russians because they're, and they're living on Russian soil because they're Russians. And I'm wondering whether your guests see a parallel in the way that the sort of the concept of ethnicity and race are playing into Putin's rhetoric in Ukraine.
Tim, that's an interesting comment. Let me toss it first to you, Charles Kupchin. Go ahead.
A great question, Tim, and I think that you're right to put your finger on the race and ethnicity card, because it's something that Putin has been playing all along, but he seems to have upped the ante in a way that is different. If you go back to Putin 1.0, when he was president for the first time, he complained about NATO expansion. He complained about missile defense. He complained about other things the United States were doing that he thought trampled on Russia's legitimate security interests, but he always held back from going so far as to talk about reconstituting some kind of geopolitical bloc and defending the rights of ethnic Russians. Then he ran for re-election. My own assessment, I'd be interested to hear Angela's view, was that he was using the bluster and this talk of Eurasian Union as a tool to build up his domestic support. And I expected it to kind of ramp back down after he returned to the Kremlin, but that has not happened. And now he is rallying the nationalists at home, rallying the security services, the bureaucracy, the pensioners, his domestic base, with this rhetoric about the defense of ethnic Russians and the defense of Russia's traditional territory. And it's worrisome, because it does mean that he is now stirring up all kinds of historical ghosts, and that he's willing to play a dangerous game of roulette with the West in a way that he has not been since he emerged as Russia's leader.
Do you see those parallels, Angela?
I do. Let me say that for the past 10 years, I've been part of a group, and every year we have had dinner with Mr. Putin, 3-4 hour dinners, so he likes to talk. And the themes that, we've heard in the last few weeks, we've heard those themes for the last 10 years. This isn't something new. It's just that I believe that Putin has built up this resentment over the last 10 years, feeling that the West has disrespected him, hasn't taken Russia's interests into account. And now that Russia has built its military up further, learned lessons from the Georgia War, it's in a position to try and implement all of these views that Putin has had before. And I don't think that the Eurasian Union was just a domestic ploy in the last election. I think Putin's fundamental goal is to prevent any Western structures from moving any closer to Russia and to consolidate a new Russian sphere of influence there. What was really disturbing about, or one of the things that was disturbing about the speech on March 18th, announcing the annexation of Crimea, was that for the first time, Putin kept using the Russian word for Russian as an exclusive ethnic term. The more politically correct term since the collapse of the Soviet Union has been a word that is more inclusive for citizens of Russia, even if they aren't ethnically Russian. And so that's given a lot of people a lot of pause, and they're just worrying about how much he's going to use a nationalist card. So far, to my knowledge, he has not said that wherever ethnic Russians live, they're on Russian soil. That he has not said. And, you know, he's not Slobodan Milosevic. I don't think that he wants to unleash wide-scale, you know, war and ethnic cleansing. I think he can accomplish what he wants to do without doing that, through destabilization and through appealing to groups like those in eastern Ukraine and like those in Transnistria and other parts of the former Soviet Union, who in fact think that they would be better off under Russian rule, because they, you know, their lives, their economic standard of living would be better. But I do think he has, of course, opened an entire question now about the role of ethnic Russians and their relationship to Moscow, which could have quite dangerous precedents.
Tim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We have another tweet, this one from Mitchell. In practical terms, are the West's hands tied here? Are we resigned to press conferences and some sanctions? Charles Kupchan, are those the options facing the West?
You know, I think this has been a difficult issue for European leaders and for Washington, because it is a very serious development. I would say it's the most significant threat to the post-Cold War European order that we've seen since the fall of the Berlin Wall. Yet it does not rise to the occasion of a first-order national security emergency. We're not talking about an immediate threat to the United States or the territory of American allies in Europe. So I think what's happened here is that the Europeans and the Americans have felt their way forward, have tried to find a mix of policies, including sanctions, including the isolation of Russia, going from G8 to G7, stopping contact between NATO and Russia, suspending the G8 summit in Sochi, which was scheduled for June. And then you have NATO trying to beef up its activities and defenses in the central frontier, its eastern frontier. And these are all ways of, I think, trying to find that middle ground, saying that this is unacceptable, that what Russia does violates an international rules-based order, but not rushing to man the barricades in a way that could escalate the situation. But, you know, a lot depends on what Putin's next moves are. My best guess is that we are going to get out of this one without a return of some kind of geopolitical division reminiscent of the Cold War. But, you know, we have to keep in mind that World War I, World War II, the Cold War did not start with something like the invasion of France. They start with small aggressive steps that were not responded to sufficiently, and I think that history is one of the reasons that the Western powers are saying to Putin, this is a very serious violation of international norms.
Well, Angela Sten, even looking at the title of your book, The Limits of Partnership, and it seems that looking at what is it, four presidents, I guess, since the fall of the Soviet Union, that there have been a number of resets, but still trying to figure out our relationship with this very important country.
Yeah, well, we've had four resets since the collapse
four
of the
resets,
Soviet
okay.
Union.
Four resets, okay. Right.
Four American administrations. Each one has come into office. Now, admittedly, a Bush 41 only overlapped with the new Russia for 1 year. But each has come into office trying to find a better way of interacting with Russia, a more productive relationship. The problem is our idea of what a better relationship with Russia would be is very different from what the Russian idea of what a better relationship with the United States would be. Because for them, it would be that we recognize that despite the collapse of the Soviet Union, they do in fact have the sphere of privilege interests, and that we really don't have any right to be there. I mean, that's the bottom line here. We've never been willing to say that we recognize this, and we're not going to do that. But from the Russian point of view, you know, we haven't taken their interests into account. And so, I mean, the reset, I would say, was over when Mr. Putin granted temporary political asylum to Edward Snowden. And of course, he's just rubbed it in our eyes again. again, with having Snowden ask a question at this press conference that we were hearing about. So that reset was over. It's possible that when the next American president is elected, they too will try to find the magic key to improve relations with Russia. But I think it's going to be very difficult. Mr. Putin could be in office until 2024. So we are going to be living with this difficult relationship at least until then.
But what does it mean to, from the Russian perspective, to take their interests into account in its relationship with the United States? What would that look like?
Well, what it would look like is saying, for instance, with Ukraine, that we understand that Ukraine has historic ties to Russia. Again, it should be a neutral country. It should be a federalized country. Whatever Russia says it needs in order to feel kind of secure, that we would recognize that. And then also in other parts of the former Soviet Union. So I think for Russia, that's certainly the bottom line, and to recognize, in a sense, that the world is divided into spheres of influence. Eastern Europe, what used to be Eastern Europe, is no longer part of the Soviet bloc. I mean, I think the Russians recognize Poland, the Baltic states, they've gone. But that there would be a de facto, if not repartition, a recognition that this part of the world, should have a special relationship with Russia, and that we should step back from that.
Well, about a minute before we have to say goodbye, Charles Kupchan, I'm giving you the last word. What do you see, I guess, in the next week or couple of weeks going forward? What will you be looking for?
I think we're going to be in a murky situation, and that's because the situation on the ground in eastern Ukraine remains ambiguous. I think the key will be, number one, can we avoid an open confrontation? We've already seen some bloodshed at various checkpoints in eastern Ukraine. But can we avoid something that would look like a serious military escalation? And that could come not just from the Russians, but also from right-wing elements in western Ukraine who have been operating and making provocative steps. So far, it looks like Putin is going to hold back. He's not yet ready to send troops into eastern Ukraine. That's good news, because it means the door is open to diplomacy. If he heads down that road and it could be provoked by violence, then I do think we're going to see Washington push for harsher sanctions, and then we are looking at something that could grow much more serious in geopolitical terms.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Charles Kupchan, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And Angela Stent, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure, too. Thanks.
You're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, podcasts, email archives, and satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.